This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Political catch-ups on MPR. Yes, good morning. It is political catch-up time here on Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi ona tangata o Manawatu. And it is a Friday morning, so we are here to korero torongapu with our mema parimata o papaioia, Ian Lees Galloway, atamari e to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, last week when you were here, I've told you this already, but for the benefit of the listeners, there seems to be a consensus that we're sure you were saying some good things, but you just sounded in agony. You've also told us that you've been told off by the speaker and you should be going home and not spreading germs. Do you wish to just reiterate what you said last week?
Well, I don't appear to be unwell. I have attempted antibiotics as an answer to whatever's going on in my throat. That didn't work, so presumably this is not a virus, would have been gone by now, so it seems to be not a virus, not a bacterial. I want to assure the listeners and the constituents that I'm off to see a specialist next week, and we'll see if we can get to the bottom of this.
Hopefully
he'll write me a nice letter that I can take to Mr. Speaker and explain what's going on.
Now, also a heads up to listeners, next Friday we will not be here because I will be with my children during the school holidays, which leads me on to another point. I saw you last night at the Regent Theatre, you and your lovely wife there to support your son who's at Ross Intermediate in the school production.
Yes.
It seems to be school production season at the moment, and I guess there must be an element of pride where you're concerned in your constituency, because all of these kids are getting the opportunity to perform in a facility as grand as the Regent. That's a pretty special thing.
It really is. And I mean, we are so lucky to have the Regent. And if you think back, I mean, I think the 20th anniversary of the reopening was last year or the year before. And that must have been last year, actually, because I was actually involved in the reopening celebrations, and I'd only just arrived in Palmerston North when it happened. And of course, you know, the years before that, a conscious decision was made to save the Regent. And thank goodness the community came together and did that, because it really is a wonderful facility and brilliant that it's being operated in the way that it is, that it can produce both amazing professional shows, incredibly high quality local amateur shows like Les Miserables, and also provide a community venue that our schools and other community organisations get to use. I mean, there must be very few people in Palmerston North who haven't been on stage at the Regent and got to experience everything that the theatre offers. So, we really are very, very lucky.
It's good to have a range of scales as well, because this sounds, you know, like the Regent's great and everyone else isn't. But Centrepoint, the Globe Theatre, the Regent Theatre, the Dark Room, you've got all these different scaled venues that suit a whole load of different things. We're really a bit spoiled for choice given the size of the city.
Absolutely. And I think I'm duty bound as the patron of the Operatic Society to remind everybody about the Abbey Theatre at the Old Teachers College as a home of amateur musical mm-hmm. theatre as well.
Hokafetu Auditorium.
Indeed. Yes, we do. We have, isn't Palmy just a wonderful place to live? We're just the right size and we've got everything that everybody needs.
Well, let's park the optimism and look at some of the things you're doing in central government at the moment, because
not sure I like that segue very much.
Well, no, I'm sure you don't. But when you get onto the scale of decision-making at central government, there's always going to be people that don't like what you're doing. And so let's look at the first item on the agenda, the RSE cap. For those that don't know, the RSE is a recognised seasonal employer, as my very brief Google search told me. And we touched on strawberries last week. Mm-hmm. The strawberry growers are still concerned, because whilst you're increasing the number of workers, you're putting pretty strict limitations on where they can be.
No,
they can live.
That's more like it. So the RSE scheme works incredibly well. And for those who haven't heard of it, this is the scheme where people mainly from the Pacific can come and do seasonal work in New Zealand. And it's limited to horticulture and viticulture. So they're basically either working on orchards, picking apples, kiwi fruit, etc., or they're working in vineyards. They can come for up to 7 months at a time. They head home, and often, you know, people come back season after season to do this work. And we have a cap on how many people can come each year, but for the last few years we have been raising that cap. The economy is strong. Those industries are thriving. They are employing New Zealanders, although we would like to see more of that. And this workforce from the Pacific makes sure that the fruit gets picked and those industries are able to make the most of the opportunities they have. However, there's a few things that I've laid down some challenges to those industries. One is I do want to see them pay more. I do want them to think about the conditions of work, and particularly around things like, you know, flexibility in hours, not demanding that people work for them full time. Thinking about, although the flip side to that, thinking about most people are from New Zealand are employed on casual agreements, whether they can provide people with a bit more certainty, whether. As they do for the RSE workers, whether the different industries that require seasonal workers can work together to create a package of work that does provide people with some certainty of work through the seasons. Mm-hmm. And accommodation is a really big deal. So you get a surge of people coming into, you know, quite often quite small regions, and we have seen an impact on the local residential housing market. Locals not being able to secure accommodation because it's being set aside for the seasonal workers.
That though, I mean, is probably small fry in comparison to our general population growth and the lack of keeping up with that in terms of housing stock.
Absolutely. We inherited a housing crisis from the previous government, and these things are linked. Absolutely. So it's exacerbated by the fact that we have a general lack of housing. Then you inject a surge of people into a small community, and it just exacerbates the whole thing. So, again, a lot of employers are making good progress. I've visited in the last year some excellent new accommodation in Marlborough, some very good new accommodation in Hawke's Bay. In Hawke's Bay, I have to say the council have really come to the party by saying that they can use that accommodation for workers, and then outside of the season, they can use it as emergency accommodation. So it's helping to deal with the social housing issue. One of the complaints that a lot of the employers have is that the councils say they can only use that accommodation for workers. So it sits empty for a large chunk of the year.
So a question, because I mean, it seems to me on the face of it that this could be addressed quite simply by employing New Zealanders in these fields. Then you've got New Zealanders using the New Zealand housing. You don't have this influx from overseas. This is, you know, this is not racially motivated, but if it's New Zealanders, then you're putting New Zealanders into New Zealand housing, which tackles another issue.
Look, there's a couple of problems with that. One is yes, we absolutely do want to see opportunities for New Zealanders, and a lot of the employers, they do work closely with MSD. That is often where they're sourcing New Zealand workers. You know, they're working with MSD to get people who are on benefits or people who don't have work into that work. Transport is often an issue. So they do, you know, often they will provide transport for their RSE workers, but they don't provide transport for the local workers. So we do, you know, we want to see that. So that's to get them to and from work. They're often, you know, often when you think about the people who could do these jobs, who need these jobs, low-income people, possibly on a benefit, may not actually have their own transport to be able to get to and from the orchard or the vineyard. So we really encourage the employers to help with that. If I can just finish this point. Often, of course, people do actually have to move around. The seasons shift around. The picking time shifts around the country, and people even from New Zealand do have to move with the seasons. And that means accommodation is still required. I did. I spent a bit of time working on an orchard back in my younger days. I slept in a tent because I slept on site in a tent because I had to go from here over to Hawke's Bay to do that work. So even from within New Zealand, people still need accommodation and transport.
But if you're saying that you're encouraging these employers to work together to provide some certainty, maybe in one region where people can just work in that region year round because the seasons change, there's always going to be work there. If you're doing that for overseas workers, if these employers are providing transport for these overseas workers, if they're providing accommodation for these overseas workers, how is it more difficult to do that for New Zealand employees?
It's not. And as I say, I think that the whole RSE scheme does need a bit of a refresh. And the opportunity here is for a win-win where the employers have the certainty that they're going to get the workforce that they need, and the government, representing the people of New Zealand, gets a lot more certainty that we're seeing improvements in wages, that we're seeing more New Zealanders being employed, seeing the accommodation being provided, those barriers to New Zealanders being employed lowered, that there's greater use of automation to make the whole picking of these crops more more efficient and to make sure that the jobs that are available are more attractive jobs. So what we've said is, look, we think the scheme is working well, but we think we could do it a lot better. There could be a lot more forward planning. So we're about to do a big piece of work with the industry to change up the way the scheme works to try and get those win-wins that we're looking for. In the interim, what we've said is, look, we understand you do need more people. They asked us for 3,000 more people through the RSE scheme this year. Basically, I said, we'll meet you halfway, give you 1,550 this year, another 1,600 next year. Now, that's the first time we've told them what next year's cap increase is going to be. So that's to help them give a little bit more certainty. But we're saying, if you need 3,000 more people, go halfway with the RSE scheme. Really want you to work harder to find the other half from within New Zealand.
And you are working on tools to support them in doing that along, because, you know, it looks like there's a lot of investment and time going into the RSE scheme. Is there equal investment going into finding New Zealanders to do these jobs
as absolutely.
Well?
And if you look at some of the work that Carmel Cipollone is doing as the Minister of Social Development, that Willie Jackson's doing as the Minister of Employment, this is all designed to support especially young people, the so-called NEETs, the young people who are not in education or training or work to pick up these jobs. Now, look, people will say to me that, you know, these are not career jobs, and I agree. But getting up every morning, going and doing a day's work, you know, being appropriately dressed, having your lunch, you know, all of those attributes are really important. And being able to get a reference on your CV, those are really important things as a stepping stone to people being able to get more long-term work. So the other point I would make is, across these industries that use the RSE scheme, only 20% of their workforce comes from the RSE scheme. So a really huge part of their workforce does come from within New Zealand. And, of course, the other group of people that they use a lot is working holiday visa holders. But actually we're seeing fewer and fewer of those going into these industries because there are so many opportunities in New Zealand that they are looking elsewhere where the conditions are better.
I have so many more questions about this, but we will move on. There are other things to talk about. We are here with Ian Lees-Galloway, MP for Palmerston North, Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and Immigration, which that sort of falls within the realm of.
Squarely.
Yes, but well, yes. In terms of, and now we turn to your ACC responsibilities, where a deficit has been reported. Now the numbers here just boggle my mind. So what I've managed to find out is that ACC have reported an 8.7 billion with a B deficit, due predominantly to record low interest rates. Yes, my eyes are glazing over too, dear listener. But apparently this is just on paper.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. There's a $570 million with an M dollars cash surplus. ACC remain positive. No restrictions required at this stage. But by God, those are big numbers.
Yeah. So what you've got to remember is ACC holds $44 billion worth of assets. And the reason it does that is ACC is required to have enough assets to fund the lifetime costs of all the claims on its books. And so it projects out over 100 years what are the lifetime costs of these claims, and it has to have enough money in the bank, or more to the point, money invested, because it does invest heavily in the New Zealand economy to be able to meet those costs. And essentially that does two things. It means that we don't leave a debt to future generations. So if you or I got injured today and we needed to be cared for the rest of our lives, rather than saying, you know, as we get into our dotage, that the next generation has to pay for that, we want to know that we've got the money in the bank now to be able to cover those future costs. And then the money that they are putting in will be to cover themselves and their generation.
So they hold $44 billion. Yeah. One-fifth of that is basically not there.
No. So, right. So this is really important. This is an accounting deficit. So what has happened is, so they hold $44 billion, and then they go, and so what they do is they project out over 100 years, and they go, what do we need invested today to meet that future cost? And basically they think the cost in 100 years' time is $90 billion, and so they thought they needed $44 billion in the bank today. So think about it this way. Say you needed $100 in a year's time. Mm-hmm. If you invested $90 if you put it in a bank account that had a 10% interest rate, in a year's time, you would have pretty much $100. You'd need $90 today to have $100 in a year's time. If the interest rate fell to 1%, you would need $99 in the bank today to have $100 in a year's time. So, and that's what's happened. So the interest rates have fallen. And so to be able to have $90 billion in 100 years' time, instead of needing $44 billion in the bank today, we need $53 billion in the bank today. And that is where that accounting deficit comes from.
So is the positivity there because we expect interest rates to rise again?
Yeah. So look, if you look back over the last 12 years, ACC has been in so-called deficit four times, I think. It's been in surplus five times, and it's been sort of break even, you know, and all of those are more than $1 billion each way. Mm-hmm. And then it's been break even, sort of, you know, less than $1 billion one way or the other.
I love the way you so flippantly say, oh, you know, within a billion.
When you're talking about a scheme that's $44 billion.
Yeah, I know, yeah, but you're used to these numbers.
I know. What matters is over time. How do they take care of this over time? And I would also point out, and this came up in the House yesterday, is the last time ACC was facing this scale of deficit was back in 2009. And what the government did at that point in time, and Nick Smith was the ACC minister, is that they overreacted. They did hike up levies and say, oh my goodness, we need to hike up everybody's levies to be able to meet this shortfall. And what happened was in fast order, everything kind of turned around, and then ACC became massively overfunded. We'd been charging, basically the government had been charging people far too much on their ACC levies, and the levies started to come back down again. Now that kind of volatility isn't actually very good for levy payers, because all, you know, you and I pay levies as workers, businesses pay levies as employers, all sorts of different people pay levies. Now for you and I, it's bad enough to have our levies jumping around. For businesses that are trying to budget and project forward what their costs are going to be, they need stability.
Because the levies sneak in everywhere, don't they? They sneak into like your car. Yep. Rego and stuff, yeah, as well. Right. They're all over the place.
Yeah, so you've basically got three accounts. You've got the work account, which is the employers. You've got the earners account, which is workers. And you've got the motor vehicle account, which is your car rego and your
petrol. All right, it's not all over the place.
Your car rego and your petrol and what have you. So, what we try to do is make sure that each of those accounts has enough money in it to cover all the costs in each of those accounts. But we also want to make sure that we keep those levies reasonably stable over time. We don't want them hurtling up and then hurtling down, which is what did happen when the previous government kind of panicked in 2009. So we don't want to overreact. We want to approach this sensibly. And you're absolutely right. If we're projecting out over 100 years, even if we are going into a period of low interest rates now, which is what a lot of economists are predicting, over 100 years, we can expect those interest rates to turn around. So what's most important is right now, everybody's covered. We have enough money in the bank to cover everyone's claims right now. And frankly, for the next 20 years, everything's perfectly fine. We need to start thinking about what does the future look like. But yeah, as I said, ACC generates a lot of its income from those investments. So it generated $5.1 billion worth of income last year from its investments. So, and for 27 years straight, they've generated a return of more than 10%. It's actually incredible. They are a stellar performer amongst New Zealand investment funds. So that really helps. That helps to keep those levies under control and to keep them down as well. So we're going to take a measured approach to this, and there's really no need to overreact like National did back in 2009.
To what extent were some of the ACC projections ruffled by the I don't want to say cack-handed approach, but the less than efficient way that census data has been collated and all the stats around, you know, projections on population growth and that sort of thing?
It's got absolutely nothing to do with the census data. It's simply looking at what they know about the range of claims that they've got on the books, what their projections are about the lifetime costs of those claims, and then, as I say, you know, the real impact here. So, in fact, it's an $8.7 billion paper deficit. Actually, the change in the interest rates generated $10 billion worth of loss, if you will. The other activities that ACC undertakes, its injury prevention activities, its investments, its changes in the way it's delivering its service, which are designed to be better for claimants, but also to deliver a more efficient service, that's actually limited. I know we're talking eye-watering numbers here, but it's actually limited that deficit back to $8.7 billion. So ACC is actually operating very well. They have got good data. They're not reliant on that census data. And I think people can have total confidence that ACC will continue to manage its business in a responsible fashion and that the government will take a measured approach to this.
And to think I freak out when I can't balance the $200 petty cash. We are here with Ian Lees-Galloway, MP for Palmerston North, Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, ACC and Immigration. A few minutes left. Let's touch on the Manawatu Gorge option. I've seen a lot of people happy, predominantly, that there has been some sort of confirmation or guarantee that there's going to be like a cycle lane and a way for other people to access that area as well. Because this is new landscape for a lot of people when this road goes in. No one will have been up there before.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So I mean, what we got this week is the absolute final confirmation. It's going ahead, and as you say, it's going ahead with the cycleways and all of that. So we've been through that next phase from agreeing that it should go ahead, have to go through all the consenting and what have you. So we're now at that final decision from NZTA. Yes, absolutely. Powering ahead, so hopefully we'll start to see work happening in the near future.
So soil will be turned soon?
Soon,
and
yes,
continue to be turned for what? They said six, seven years?
Yeah, it's a big project. Yeah. You know, these things do take time, and yeah, frankly, we've got a lot of construction going on around the country. We're going to have to find the people. We're going to have to put them somewhere. I suspect you're probably going to see some
an increase in RSE caps.
well, they don't. It doesn't apply to construction, but yeah, to be fair, the construction industry is heavily reliant on migrant workforce at the moment. That's because we inherited a situation where our polytechnics, our vocational training system, was not working well and not delivering us the people that we need, with, and not giving New Zealanders the skills to pick up the opportunities that are being generated by our economic growth. Chris Hipkins is working very hard on that. And actually, can I just, as a sidebar, my work in immigration is closely linked to what Chris is doing in education, because those two combined are what provide the skills that we need.
I mean, we have come full circle pretty much. When the issues we talked about with the RSE cap are prevalent here. If we are using migrant workers to build the Gorge Road, we're going to have an influx of people and nowhere to put them because there are no houses.
Indeed, and I was about to say we're probably going to see some worker accommodations springing up around Ashurst. It becomes a bit circular, right? You know, we don't have enough people to build the roads and houses that we need, but we don't have enough houses to house the people that we need to build the roads and houses. I mean, we've inherited Can I say Buggers Muddle on your station?
Well, you just did.
Thank you. We've inherited one of those from the previous government. Not enough work done to get ahead of these issues. And so you've got to do a bit of, you've got to do what's the short-term solution and work on the long-term solution. I think the short-term solution is, yeah, we are going to have to get some more people into the country to and make sure that the immigration system is focused on getting the people that we need to do that kind of work. But over time, what we have to do is make sure that we are training people here who are already here in New Zealand to be able to pick up those opportunities. There is a bit of a mismatch between the skills that New Zealanders have and the skills that we actually need as a country. Mm. It's a shame that this hasn't been worked on before, but we're getting on with it.
We've got a couple of minutes left. We've got pop quiz time. Uh-oh. Why not? Although the first thing I want to say is it's election year next year. If you get back in, how long can you keep saying we inherited this problem, we inherited this problem, it's all a bugger's muddle? See, I did it as well now. At some point, it's going to just have to be a case of, we are working on this issue, what happened in the past, we can't really reference that anymore.
Well, the cynic in me would point out that I'm pretty sure the National Party were doing it right up until they got turfed out.
But you're bigger than that, aren't you?
I think it's fair. I reckon, actually, I remember seeing an article, I think, on the spin-off about this, and they asked various people, and they came to the conclusion that it's about 3.5 to 4 years into an administration's term that they can that they probably have to ditch the, we inherited a mess message. But I think, people do understand that a lot of this is not, I mean, of course, I'm a politician, I am going to point out the failings of the previous government, but a lot of it has actually come from the sort of economic orthodoxy that we've been working under for the last 30 or 40 years. And these things have built up over time. And we are saying, actually, we do need to take a new direction. But things that build up over 30 or 40 years are going to take a little bit of time to work on. But our focus is not just to think about the next 3 years, not just to think about the next election, but actually what is happening over the next 30 years and what changes do we need to make today to make sure that we continue on a path that over the next 2-3 decades takes us to where we need to be on things like climate change, on freshwater management, on building infrastructure. All of those things need a much more long-term outlook than perhaps our current political system encourages.
Right, pop quiz. Will Boris Johnson be Prime Minister come the Brexit deadline in the end of October? Yes or no?
Yes.
Really? Oh, very interesting. Will Trump be impeached?
No.
Wow. God, you're a cynic. Should the voting age be 16?
Yes.
Will there be, in some form as you see it at the moment, will it be passed, the end of life choice bill?
Yes, but I think it will go to referendum.
Right. And similarly, with the discussions around abortion at the moment, will women have that freedom of choice? Will that come through as you see it at the moment?
Yes, and it won't go to referendum.
Ooh, there we go. Predictions. We've managed to get him to have that. They're pretty. You really think Boris is going to survive?
Well, to the date that you gave me.
Ah, right. Okay. Only because no one else wants the job, I suppose. Ian Lees-Galloway, MP for Palmerston North, Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, ACC and Immigration. Thank you for joining us on the Political Catch-Up this morning. A reminder to listeners that there won't be a fresh one next week, school holidays and the like, but you can hear this one again. Hopefully we'll catch up with you after that. And if you want to hear this or previous editions of the Catch-Up series, just head to the website npr.nz/show/catch-up. Ian Lees-Galloway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Political Catch-Up on NPR. Also available on demand at npr.nz. Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.